Have you ever been to extended family Kingston?
Stop by and visit our programs and talk to our staff to find out how our staff will support you.
So many things we like best are golf,
doing crafts,
hanging friends,
and gardening.
I like doing everything at EAF. We just love extended family.
Visit us at www.efkingston.com.
Come on down to EFK, located at 660 Baggett Street, for a great time. Be a part of our extended family.
Come to extended family. Come and have some fun.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by your CFRC News Collective, Ara McCauley, Jesse Bell, and Jenny Hinch. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Ara McCauley, and here are your local news headlines. The adoption of the City of Kingston's official plan was moved to 2027 at May 19th's council meeting following a lively discussion in council about whether or not to postpone the plan's approval.
First of all, I just want to thank council. This was a really vigorous, passionate debate. And this was worthy of the people who elected us all to City Council.
City Council initiated work on its new official plan framework and policies in 2023, aiming to have the new official plan approved before the end of June 2026. With the deadline fast approaching, Councillor Tozo presented a motion to request that Council direct City staff to cancel the June 30th special meeting of Council and the June 18th special meeting of Planning Committee to direct staff to release additional supporting studies and plans when available, in accordance with the Council endorsed medium growth scenario for public review and feedback, and submit an updated third draft and recommendation report to Council in 2027. Councillor Tozo argued that while City staff should be commended for the work they have put into the plan thus far, important supporting plans such as the Natural Heritage Study, Integrated Mobility Plan, and others are still in progress.
Tonight I'm asking Council to defer the third draft of and the new official plan until 2027. I think, to be clear, you all know I hate deferrals. We're elected to make decisions and own those decisions once they're made. We're also elected to make decisions on the best information possible. Several studies that support the official plan are still in progress, such as the Natural Heritage Study, the Integrated Mobility Plan, Water and Wastewater, which won't be complete until late fall, and the financial analysis of this all won't be completed until early 2027. Council needs this information to make the best possible decision when considering expanding the urban boundary, a decision that has significant and far-reaching implications. On the direction of Council, City staff have completed a tremendous amount of work, and thus far I think there's a lot to be proud of. I'd like to highlight the contributions of several staff members: Laura Flaherty, Paige Agnew, Tim Park, Neil Odie, Sukriti Agarwal, Matt Cusson, Ian Semple, and their teams, just to name a few. The citizens of Kingston should be proud of the tireless work of their dedicated public servants. The one reason I'm putting this forward I think that's valuable to highlight is just the costing aspect. I think beyond everything else, we do need to know the high-level costs, and we won't get that till 2027.
In his motion, he also noted that some members of the public have expressed a desire for more time to review supporting studies and the draft plan prior to City Council making a decision on the final official plan. The council meeting began with several delegations speaking to the plan, addressing concerns over its implementation, citing a lack of finished data and outdated projections on population, which could have significant impact on the urban boundary expansion.
It will shape how Kingston grows, where housing goes, how infrastructure is funded, what environmental protections are put in place, and ultimately what kind of city we leave to the future generations. This is about making sure we get this right. Both council and the public are being asked to review an extremely large and complex final draft with very limited time before the final adoption vote. I do not believe this is the best way to make a decision that will affect Kingston for decades. Good decisions require complete information.
The official plan is underpinned by the population projections of the 2023 Watson and Associates report. I hope to convince you that the population projection must be reassessed in light of the COVID blip and recent downgrade in immigration and international student visa allocation, in addition to the challenging geopolitical instability starting over the past year. The projections by the city used to underpin the official plan increased by roughly 50,000 people using the historical projection from 2019 versus that from 2023. And this was before the downturn in post-secondary programs at St. Lawrence College and Queen's University. The provincial projections show a roughly 10,000 person decrease between their 2021 and 2025 update. The Stats Canada update in 2025 shows an even greater decrease to near 160,000 permanent residents in 2051.
Not every councillor was in favour of the delay, however. Councillor Oosterhoff argued that the deferral undermined the hard work of city staff.
I'm not so crazy about this motion. I think that this motion passes, we actually have not done our jobs. I think that we are providing inconsistent leadership to our staff. They have done a good job. We did compliment them, or more than that, we acknowledge their excellence. It's like a backhanded slap to me to see that we have to now say that we need more time.
And cautioned unintended consequences.
And here we are in total Lake Kingston, just delaying again or failing to show leadership to me. And it's just very frustrating to see this and causing what I think is potentially a problem down the road with a new council, a new mandate.
Commissioner Agnew was on hand to speak to council about the work staff has done on the report.
From a staff perspective, our main goal has always been to deliver council a plan that is progressive, is something that takes the city into the future and something that you can stand behind. Proud of the work and feeling that it's been well substantiated by all the technical information. So that is our goal at the end of the day. Some councillors may not be in a position where they feel like there's been enough time for council and the public to absorb the information because there's been a lot of it in a fairly short period of time. And we understand that that was always going to be the case with the project schedule that was endorsed from the very beginning because it was aggressive and the goal was to deliver a plan for this council to make a decision on.
Councillor Glenn asked Agnew about the methodology used in staff's population projections and what measures were in place to course correct if projections were wrong.
Because we continue to hear conflicting statistics, conflicting information, different points of view. So I want to understand what would happen if we're wrong on our assumptions and what would happen if we had to modify the assumption.
It's a 25-year projection and there isn't a level of mathematical certainty that I can give council in year 15, 20, or 25 that would probably satisfy anybody in the room. That's why there are multiple checkpoints from an overall governance perspective with how plans are administrated and how they're ground truthed and how they're revalidated through the process of the course of a life of a plan, because the province asks municipalities to plan between that 20 and 25 year time frame. So we're looking at it annually, we're doing check-ins in 5 years, and then we're doing a comprehensive review every 10 years.
While Councillor Stephen argued that the concerns over the population projection data was being blown out of proportion.
The people who are talking about growth projection changes are talking to themselves. We have already made a decision and we know, even if the misinformation is simplifying things, we know that we can change this in the future, that whatever we do is not set in stone. And I'll give you an example, because the old OP that we're under right now was supposed to carry us through to 2036, and it's 2026 and we've already outgrown it. So, I mean, we could decrease our population projections and underplan again. But what I'd rather do is take the medium growth scenario that we already chose, aim for a balanced approach, hope that we're pretty close, and adjust as we go, because that's the reasonable thing to do, and that's what the legislation says. And anyone who says otherwise is making it up. They don't know what they're talking about.
Further questions touched on the outstanding reports and their impact on the final plan.
In progress, we still have the Integrated Mobility Plan and the Wastewater Master Plan. So they have done substantial work to influence the second draft that's out and that has been out for public consumption in terms of all the technical inputs that need to go into that plan. Those plans continue on beyond the life of the completion of the official plan, usually in terms of their technical modeling and getting into the detailed work that actually lives in those plans, and it's not in the official plan. The official plan is more of the high level enabling that has the technical information only to a certain level. So that work is going to be ongoing into the fall for both of those studies, but that's always been the case. We're working to finish the natural heritage study. So that is in the process under Mr. Park's leadership of taking and finalizing the feedback that's come from the consultation that took place over the last couple of months. And that study will be finalized and presented to council. There's a lot of it that's already in draft two. The remainder of it gets refined and put into draft three.
Deputy Mayor Boehm read the new motion with consolidated amendments ahead of the final discussion.
Here's the motion as amended. Whereas City Council initiated work on its new official plan framework and policies in 2023 with a work plan aiming to have a new official plan approved before the end of June 2026. And whereas, although a number of background studies supporting the official plan have been released, there are still upcoming important supporting plans such as the Natural Heritage Study, Integrated Mobility Plan, and others that are in progress. And whereas some members of the public have expressed a desire for more time to review supporting studies and the draft plan prior to City Council making a decision on the final official plan. Therefore, be it resolved that Council directs City staff to cancel the June 30th special meeting of Council and the June 18th special meeting of Planning Committee, and the staff be directed to hold an information session in Q1 2027 in order to provide information to both the public and the Council elected for the 2026-2030 term regarding the official plan, and that Council directs staff to release additional supporting studies and plans when available in accordance with the Council-endorsed medium growth scenario for public review and feedback, and submit an updated third draft of the new official plan together with an accompanying recommendation report no later than June 30, 2027, following the completion of outstanding supporting studies, public engagement, and technical review.
Councillor Glenn commended the decision to defer, citing confusion and distrust around the process from constituents.
So I think it's critical that we get back on the same page. There's been a lot of confusion, and I think it's creating distrust in this process.
Other council members offered their support, though several did so while expressing reservations.
I am disappointed. Every time we have something like this, we always run away. We always try to defer things, to defer the reports or whatever due to some of the political pressure. I am voting for it, but it's not that I'm voting from the bottom of my heart. I have two reasons. The reason is my colleagues were working hard on it. They have some pressure from the constituents. I have a pressure from the constituents, but it's totally political. But also, I'm embarrassed to tell you that we are disrespecting the staff's hard work behind it. We need to change our culture here. We need to either give the direction to the council. We should have enough time for the public to be engaged. But I don't know when we have 2 months, 3 months, we advertise, or the council advertise, or staff advertise to get involved. People don't get involved.
So I just want to be clear that deferring the decision about adopting the official plan doesn't mean that we're not expanding. We have to do it. If we don't do it, if council puts our head in the sand and says, we don't want to expand the urban boundary because people don't like it, well then guess what? The province is going to do it for us. And I'm pretty sure they don't care about our natural heritage system the way we do. So I'm going to support this because if people need more time after months of reviewing it and they still can't seem to get through the material, okay. But also, I just want to be clear, we have professional staff working here at the City of Kingston. They work for everyone. They are us. We are the city. The people who live here are the city. And these are the professionals we have hired to do the job. And when people are characterizing it as urban sprawl and copying and pasting emails to us, I wonder if they've even read the plan. It's been online for months. So if you want to be involved, oh my gosh, yes, get involved, but go straight to the source. You can't rely on Facebook comments and email chains. That's not the real information. It's partial information. It's rooted in truth, but it's not the whole story. Things like this are much more complex, and misinformation is doing us all a disservice. So if you have questions, if you're in the public, ask us, ask staff. They have the answers, and we want the answers too, because we want to do right by the community. That's the whole point of this exercise.
In the end, the motion passed with one dissenting vote from Councillor Oosterhoff.
The council has every bit of right in the coming years to manage what we do. We have guardrails. We have done our jobs this 4 years. We have a good vision, a good view of moving forward. We know we're comfortable with it. I cannot support this.
That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell with your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. We begin with the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs. We had two games over the weekend, starting with the Montreal Canadiens and the Carolina Hurricanes. After stealing game one on the road, Montreal was close, but not close enough, falling 3-2 in overtime to the Hurricanes. Their series is now tied at one game apiece. And then last night, we had Game 3 between the Vegas Golden Knights and the Colorado Avalanche. Colorado jumped out to a 3-0 lead, but they would be unable to hold that lead as Vegas slowly but surely clawed their way back into the game, ultimately winning 5-3 to take a dominant 3-0 lead in the Western Conference Final Series. Montreal and Carolina will play Game 3 of their Eastern Conference Final Series tonight with puck drop set for 8 p.m., and Vegas will try to close out Colorado tomorrow night with puck drop scheduled for 9 p.m. Switching now to the NBA, and it's a similar story to what we see in the NHL in the sense that one conference final series is very close and the other one sees a team with a commanding 3-0 lead. Let's start with the latter. The New York Knicks hold a 3-0 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers with a chance to close out the series and advance to their first NBA Finals since 1999. Tip-off is scheduled for 8 p.m. tonight. Meanwhile, over in the Western Conference, we have an absolute bloodbath of a series as the San Antonio Spurs, led by Victor Wembanyama, take on the top seed Oklahoma City Thunder, led by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And it was the Spurs that took Game 4 by a 20-point margin, 103-82, to tie the series at two games apiece. A crucial Game 5 is going to tip off tomorrow night at 8:30 p.m., and whoever wins that game very well could take the entire series. That's a wrap for the Sports Report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Reminder that you will hear more sports content Tuesday night at 5 p.m. on The Corridor, and then again Wednesday at 5 p.m. on Today in YGK. Until next time, all the best. Jesse Bell, signing off. Coming up next, your City of Kingston Traffic Report and your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Here is your City of Kingston Traffic Report. On Bath Road between Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Portsmouth Avenue, expect delays as crews continue installing intersection pedestrian signals. Over on King Street West from Country Club Drive to Front Road, expect delays as Utilities Kingston work has reduced traffic to one lane in each direction. Watch for lane shifts, reduced speeds, and shared lane signage. At the intersection of Montreal Street and John Counter Boulevard, construction is ongoing with delays expected throughout the month. Cranbrook Street from Days Road to Lakeview Avenue, as a reminder, is closed from 8:40 a.m. to 9:20 a.m. and 3:20 p.m. to 3:50 p.m. every school day as part of the School Streets program, which restricts access during school drop-off and pick-up times. Wright Crescent remains closed between Palace Road and Kingsland Crescent for roadway repairs and safety improvements. Construction continues on Princess Street from Frontenac to Division as part of a major reconstruction project. And long-term closures remain in place on Aberdeen Street between Johnson and William and Barry and Queen. Monday, May 25th, we've got a daytime high of 17 degrees, feeling closer to 20 with a nice mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 10 degrees overnight. Tuesday, May 26th, daytime high of 19 degrees with a 60% chance of precipitation in the afternoon, dropping down to 14 overnight. Wednesday, May 27th, we have got a daytime high of 20 degrees, but in the sun, it's going to be much warmer, or at least feel that way, closer to 26 degrees with a little bit of humidity, 55% chance of precipitation throughout the day, but not getting a whole lot of accumulation. Thursday, May 28th, daytime high of 19 degrees, a beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston, dropping down to 10 overnight. Friday, May 29th, 16 is your high, but feeling closer to 20 in the sunshine, dropping down to a fairly chilly 8 degrees overnight. Saturday, May 30th, daytime high of 17, feeling closer to 19 with a 58% chance of showers. Sunday, May 31st, ending off the month, a beautiful sunny 18 degree day, perfect conditions leading us into Monday, June 1st. We get another 18-degree day with lots of sunshine, feeling closer to 22 when all is said and done. That's a wrap for your traffic and weather reports. Over to CFRC's Genevieve Hinch for your concerts and events calendar.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar. Whether you're looking for live music, local markets, workshops, comedy, or just something fun to do around the city, there's plenty happening in Kingston this week. Let's get into it. Starting off with Monday, the Tet Center is hosting a Memory Vessel Paper Pulp Sculpture Workshop from 6 to 9 p.m. for anyone looking to get creative. Over at the Kingston Grand Theatre, Menopause the Musical 2 hits the stage at 7:30. Live music includes Jazz Mondays with Dave Barton at the RCHA Club, and One Tree Hill fans might want to check out Kate Bogle and Tyler Hilton performing at the Sphere at 8 p.m. Trivia also returns to Something in the Water Brewing Company later that evening. Tuesday brings a mix of community events and live music. Stories in the Park takes place at Lake Ontario Park from 6:30 to 7 p.m., while Daft Brewing hosts Euchre Night from 7 to 9. Live music includes Vincent Mossier at the Time Out Bar, Eric Urin and Megan Ballone performing at the Cove Inn, and a traditional Irish session returning to the Toucan from 7:30 to 10 p.m. On Wednesday, Spring Reverb officially kicks into gear with Canada's Music Incubator hosting a financial literacy for artists session at the Broom Factory from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. If you're looking for something social later in the evening, Something in the Water Brewing Company and the Royal Canadian Legion are both hosting board game nights, while Daft Brewing and La Vida Bistro host trivia and euchre. For something a little different, the Gananoque Pride Alliance is screening Legally Blonde at the 1000 Islands Drive-In starting at 6:30 p.m. Thursday keeps things busy with Kingston Public Market running all day in Springer Market Square from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Later on, Science Quest Animal Engineers takes place at the Calvin Park Branch Library, while Daft Brewing hosts a burlesque show from 8 to 10 p.m. Spring Reverb concerts also begin Thursday night with Slaves of Spanky, Pony Girl, and Almond Milk performing at the Broom Factory. Other live music highlights include Real Love, a Kenny and Dolly tribute at the Kingston Grand Theatre, and Divine Right alongside Casper Skulls taking over the Toucan later that night. Now, Friday is definitely packed with events all across the city. The Nature of Being exhibition opens at the Tet Gallery from 3 to 8 p.m., while downtown venues are filled with Spring Reverb performances throughout the night. The Broom Factory hosts their Dirty Nil alongside Cam Cannon and Futura Free beginning at 7:30. Forever Seeger takes over the Kingston Grand Theatre, while Something in the Water Brewing Company hosts a charity drag bingo night starting at 8 p.m. Other live music includes the Sadies at Hayloft Dance Hall, Mauricio and the Latin Beat Band at the Sphere, and Hot Garbage with Ace of Wands rocking the Toucan late into the night. Heading into Saturday, Turtle Awareness Day takes over Lake Ontario Park from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., while the Spring Reverb Punk Rock Fleet Market runs at the Broom Factory from 11 to 3. There's also a free community event called Spring Together happening at Kingston Community Health Centers from noon until 3. Live music highlights include the Frontenac Community Concert Band celebrating its 50th anniversary at Kingston Gospel Temple, Thania Iyer and Julia Finnegan performing at the Broom Factory, and Golden Feather taking over the Toucan later that night. If you're looking for a fun evening out, line dancing returns to the Buckle from 7 to 8 p.m. Wrapping things up, Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market runs until 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., while the Cataraqui Indigenous Market takes place at Confederation Park from 10 to 4. Spring Reverb continues with the recording studio tour at a mystery location with a DIY merch workshop hosted by M. Harmson at the Warehouse. Live music includes Bedouin Sound Clash performing performing at the Broom Factory at 2:30, Eric Uren and Megan Belong returning to the Cove Inn, and live band karaoke at the Merchant Tap House starting at 9 p.m. That's your weekly events and concerts calendar for May 25th through the 31st. For more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present the lead single from Rust Pump's debut eponymous EP. The song Drool Again stands out as the lead track, blending classic rock influences with a modern edge, while the song's use of seventh chords creates a melancholic, dreamy atmosphere that mirrors its exploration of a couple seeking relief through substance use. Both intimate and dynamic, Drool Again has become a favorite of the band and a lasting highlight of their sound. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Drool Again by Rust Pump on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Don't get burned by the lesson. cool if you could volunteer with Canada's oldest campus radio station? Well, sign up to volunteer with CFRC 101.9 FM today. We're always looking for new volunteers, and we offer a free training program, so no experience in radio production is necessary. You can start your own radio show or podcast, contribute to our news collective, help us sort through music sent to us by record labels and artists, help plan events, record PSAs for us, and even more. Reach out to our programming manager, Alex Fernandez, via email at programs@cfrc.ca for more information, or visit our website at cfrc.ca/volunteer and sign up today.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 318. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with educator, researcher, and author Brian Aboud. Brian is an educator at Vanier College in Montreal and has long been involved in thinking about place and social movements, also the history of different migrant communities in Montreal, particularly Arab and Syrian diasporas. Brian's work spans different generations, and he was a curator of a very important exhibition in Montreal that looked at the history of the migration of Syrian Lebanese communities into Montreal, Munyang, Jiajiage, in the early 20th century. But this conversation is really important, I think, because it tries to explore the impacts of the repression that Palestine solidarity movements have faced on campuses and colleges here locally within Quebec and Canada, but also internationally. And I think that Brian shares some really important questions about the impacts of this repression on the culture and politics of educational spaces. So here's my conversation with Brian Aboud for this edition of Free City Radio. The last couple of years has seen very intense dynamics at play in relation to college and university campuses and their both connections to state power, but also dynamics of silencing and sort of like administrative repression that's been happening. This has been clearly connected to Palestine, but also it is connected to broader questions, I think, of you know, how much autonomy an academic space has, you know, and this, I think, connects to some sort of dynamics we're seeing in the United States around an authoritarian government attempting to really curtail sort of baseline understandings of liberal educational institutions. Obviously, just ending the analysis at that point is not the full picture, right? And so, Brian, I think it's interesting to hear your vantage point as somebody who can sort of think about this moment and talk about it in relation to Palestine. And of course, I think the Quebec dynamics are important in that regard, too, in terms of understanding what's been going on here. So maybe we could just first start by just a basic introduction and maybe just zooming out. Why do you think that sort of pulling apart and understanding these dynamics of repression around college and university campus autonomy is important as a larger social political question? Like, just sort of zooming out and thinking about this, because sometimes we can kind of get lost in the sort of specifics of how it's playing out, let's say, within a university between different committees and or even a governmental committee. Yeah. But of course there's the overarching principle and overarching kind of issues at play, so maybe we could start there.
Okay, well, that's a good question, big one. Okay, so I think that there are a couple of dimensions to that. So, okay, why it is of concern. Okay, one, I guess we can go from a micro and then maybe expand this into a kind of more macro level. At the micro level, I guess it has to do with working conditions for professors, okay, and what those everyday conditions might be like for them. Going from workload matters to what can be taught in the classroom, what can be said in the classroom, relations between colleagues, relations between professors and students, and so on. So you have this kind of a set of effects that these various developments that you're mentioning will have at a micro level, and really relating to the everyday of being in education, delivering courses, dealing with colleagues, dealing with the administration, okay? And so there are definitely effects there. And the question is, you know, in what way are those effects limiting of autonomy, limiting of liberty, limiting of a workplace that is agreeable to you, that makes you feel like you're able to contribute, that makes you feel like you are being rewarded financially and otherwise in a way that is commensurate with the amount of time and effort that you're investing. And I think all of those things come into question in the present. I don't think it's a new question, though, Stefan. I think this has been going on for some time. But there is a new, but for over the last 3 years, maybe approximately, and maybe more so over the last, if we even focus more, the last 2 years, since developments in Gaza and in Palestine, Israel, I think we're seeing a new kind of, a new inflection, I guess, in what has been a more long-standing, I would say a long-standing problem in education. Look, I've been in education for 20 plus years,
yeah.
Okay, and and as an educator, also involved in matters having to do with institution, with the institution, and with the profession, and with the educational system more generally. So I've been involved in union organizing with respect to the institution. Okay, so that's what I've been observing, and then I've been involved in. So that's what leads me to say that the horizon of disruption, peril, vulnerability, risk, and so on goes beyond the frame of the last 3 years, and especially, even though, once again, what we've seen in the last 2 years is kind of exceptional. All right. Now, okay, so you have that. So you have all of this going on at what you might call a micro level. And then but those micro developments are the product of, or articulated with, or are determined by, I'm not really sure how to explain the relationship theoretically between the micro, but you have all of these macro developments also going on at over a horizon of time longer than the past 3 years. And I would say that if you want to put all of this into some kind of longer, at the macro level, what we're really looking at is changes in the function of universities and of institutions of higher education, their relationship to society and social processes, their function, probably at the broadest level, okay, their place within existing structures of hierarchy, we might say, inequality, power, okay, where does the university fit within those broad kind of structuring and structural instances and developments? Okay, maybe that's possibly the most, and over the last 40 to 50 years, we've seen kind of significant changes.
Likewise.
In that. Okay, and then I'll come to that in just a moment, but I think then we go, you know, slightly down more towards the micro, and we're looking at changes in managerial practice and in managerial processes within educational institutions. So you go from the macro, the structural level, okay, and the way in which the higher education institutions are embedded in and participate in and influence and affect the broader social processes, cultural processes, economic processes, and then you have kind of what is the changes that have gone on with respect to institutional, we've played upon the institutional management. All of these things, though, have worked together, and then you have the micro effect. Okay, so, like what? Well, I guess what I mean is, okay, first, I think all of these things work together. Now, one key dimension of what has happened over in recent years has been the change in what you might call the managerial ethos of higher education institutions. I've done some research on this, okay, for the college union and for the college federation. Not really was for the college union, but it was an issue that was raised by the union federation of CEGEPs that had to do with.
Here in Quebec,
it came up as an issue about 10 years ago or so. It was an issue having to do with changes in managerial practice, managerial process, managerial ethos within the CEGEP network. But what was happening in the CEGEP network was just a symptom or a particular example of a much broader change that has gone on with respect to management and administration in higher education over since about the 1980s or so. And it is a managerial change towards what you might call quality management. Quality management is an idea about how to manage organizations that has a much longer history than, let's say, the last 30 years or so, but its initial, the idea of managing according to a focus on quality and how to maximize quality in relation to what it is that the organization is doing and producing was, in the first instance, had to do with private enterprise, okay, and corporations and so on, how to make them run better. So this idea of what was called of quality management, which had as its kind of central tenet the idea of what is called continuous improvement. Okay, so your kind of managerial approach is towards a continuous improvement of your product. So the quality of your product has to all, you know, and everything that you do has to aim towards this. This was incorporated into higher education somewhere in the 1980s or so. Basically, you have a management approach that comes out of enhancing, increasing the success and the efficacy of private enterprise adapted into higher education. At the same time as that was happening, you had what we've noticed is, and I mean you're aware of this, a corporatization or a kind of shift towards a marketization of higher education and of universities. So these things are happening at the same time. All right, that is, I guess, kind of what, you know, the kind of macro, if you like, the macro context in which this was happening. All of this had an impact all the way down, right into the micro. No question about it. The everyday of teaching and of working in a higher education was impacted by the adoption of this managerial ethos. All right. Now, so I think that's why I'm saying that the horizon of change, you know, is longer than the last few years. But I think that what has happened over the last few years has to be understood in relation to those broader and more long-standing changes that have happened in higher education. So the concern of the current conjuncture has to do with the way in which repression has been exercised, or a form of power that we might call repression, repressive power has been exercised in higher education with respect to professors, students, disciplines, okay, the curriculum, okay. And I think that those developments are partly the outcome or in some kind of convergence with those broader changes of marketizing, corporatizing, neoliberalizing higher education, right? Because the thing is that what I think is going on is that you need to make the institution as profitable as possible in an economic sense, okay, in a corporate sense, in a capitalist sense, if you like, in a market sense, all right? So and that's just the logic that has been implanted and incorporated into higher education institutions. That's the logic now. With that logic, one of the things that you have to, in alliance with that new management ethos, is that what you need to think about a lot is risk management and risk calculation. Okay, so how do you reduce, mitigate, lessen the risks to your institution so that you stay as competitive as possible within this market, of this education market? So I think that risk mitigation is partly what explains the repressive measures that have been taken with respect to certain facets of the curriculum, and then focused in recent years on a way of examining sources and the causes of inequality and the persistence of inequality, and more specifically the way in which race and racism explain inequalities and their persistence. So we saw a response or a set of measures and steps, actions taken on the part of government, on the part of, I would say, on the part of a certain segment of the upper class that has, and maybe we may be talking about, the upper echelons of the upper capitalist class, in alliance with government and with certain political interests, okay, kind of combining to attack a certain way of talking about inequality, talking about race, talking about racism, talking about matters of identity, and so on and so forth. Okay, and the attack was focused on the manner of talking about those things that put it in a broad structural systemic perspective, linking it to capitalism and the effects of capitalism. Sure. And so I mean, okay, look, to put it more squarely, the whole attack on, not that I don't like DEI, quote unquote, okay, but that is diversity, equity, inclusion, as it's called. Okay, so you have that attack. Now, I think that DEI has can be thought of and approached from a range of, in a range of ways, okay, from liberal to rather very centrist liberal to, more radical left approaches to it. And when you get to the more radical left approaches, and you're talking DEI means something completely different than what it does to liberals. So you have that, and then you have in conjunction or in parallel, this attack on what came to be called critical race theory, okay, which was just a target that became a target of people on the right who didn't want matters of inequality, injustice, disadvantage, hierarchy to be talked about in this kind of way, okay. So I think all of these things are working. So I think part of the risk mitigation or the risk management approach to managing education was took the view that too much talk became a potential liability to the institution and put the institution in some measure of risk, where its I guess ability to attract students is concerned, where the possible damage to its reputation was concerned as well. Okay, so in order to mitigate that, you went along with the attack on the part of government, on the part of class interests, and on the part of certain sectoral interests to counter that manner of analysis and that manner of talking about questions of inequality and so on. So, okay, so then more recently, what you have is the crackdown and the steps that were taken to limit the way in which the Palestinian question was being talked about within higher education institutions. Okay, it was a manner of limiting, but also of silencing a certain way, which was a certain way of talking about the Palestine question, meaning that there was such a thing as a Palestine question. Okay, like just that very, that, as, I mean, if you, the very fact of identifying and naming a Palestine question, okay, became for certain, in certain respects and from the standpoint of certain interests, a problem. And the problem was addressed by taking steps to sanction what professors were saying, and in the process of sanctioning the sanctioning went so far as reprimand, dismissal, of certain teachers who were taking the view that there was a Palestine question. Palestine question meaning, okay, and it's in the sense in which I guess Edward Said referred to the question of Palestine, okay, that there is a question here. A question having to do with how you address an injustice, going back to 48, an injustice that to which the Palestinian people were subject. Okay, and then, okay, that question needs, that's what I mean by the Palestine question. If there's the question of injustice that needs to be addressed. Question of injustice, of rights, of liberty, and so on and so forth. Okay, so I think all of these things kind of go together. I think there's also been, so you have governmental steps being taken on the part of government in the United States and in other places. The United States probably being the most evident case and the most graphic case of taking steps in order to silence a kind of critical approach to the Palestine question. And then you have the corporate class interests. I think in all of this there are class interests that are at play here. All right, and that's pretty obvious. The people who are invested in the capitalist system as owners, as heads of corporations, okay, so I think there's a class dimension and a kind of class confrontation. Okay, and I think the people, yes, those people who are invested in the capitalist system because they profit and benefit from its workings to the greatest degree, want to see this kind of critical discussion, critical analysis, reduced, if not, kind of eliminated entirely, because it puts their own interests at stake. Mm-hmm. I think that, okay, addressing the Palestine question from a critical standpoint that recognizes. Okay, that there are legitimate claims on the part of the Palestinians that have to be addressed, and that we have to, and that in doing so, you have to address the entire configuration of
you know, power arrangements in the Middle East, certainly between Israel and the Palestinians, but even more broadly, all of that configuration has to be kind of, you know, really questioned in from a critical standpoint, and it puts, yes, those interests at risk. Mm-hmm. And so so I think, you know, corporate interests had a stake and a role. Their interests converged with right-wing governmental interests in silencing what could be said about Palestine on campuses, whether by professors or by students. And then I guess a third player in all of this are what you might call the, I guess, sectional interests. I'm trying to think of a way in which to put it. Okay, but the organizations public advocacy interests that support the narrative about Israel-Palestine that does not recognize as legitimate any of the Palestinian claims. Those were also at play in their private. So I guess in a way, the kind of private interests, whether they were organizations or individuals like lawyers and so on, who were taking various kinds of steps to target professors, target student organizations, target student activism in order to contain what was, you know, what was emerging after in 2023, manifested or exemplified most strongly by those encampments from, you know, early 2024 through into the summer of 2024. I think this was a really big challenge to all of those interests.
That was a conversation with educator, author, and curator Brian Aboud, speaking on the impacts of repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement on campuses and universities in Quebec and Canada, but also beyond. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. We're also a podcast. Just look us up. Search Free City Radio. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.